families, poorest families. I looked at where are the best schools in the world. And I found that there are 10 best schools in the world. The Dutch teach their children two or three languages, the best in the world. They are also best in maths. Some of the children, 14-year-olds, apparently are the best in the world in the sense that the Dutch educational curriculum for maths is the best. Then I heard that the Italians do the best in preschool teaching, the Montessori system and all that. The Japanese apparently give the best education in science education. The New Zealanders give the best to education for primary school children to how to read fast and quickly. And then I found also that the Swedes apparently provide the best adult education opportunities for everybody. So you studied something 20 years ago and you forgot, you can go to night school and do it. And United States, the best for the postgraduate training, in other words, PhDs and so on, the best in the world. So I thought, what could I learn from others? So I got the Dutch to come to us to try and develop our curriculum for maths. And then the New Zealanders, I sent my assistant to see the New Zealand ambassador in India, who was Sir Edmund Hillary, who was the Everest. So he said, yes, I'll give you two teachers for New Zealand teachers. So a couple of months later, we had two New Zealand teachers who teaches English, how to get reading and writing skills very quickly into their system. So two New Zealand teachers, one Dutch maths curriculum developer, were working with BRAC right from the start. And we got some of the best curriculum in terms of the New Zealand teachers, of course, don't know Bangla, but they know how to teach English in a way. So we learned how to really get our children up to speed very quickly in learning to read. And that's so our children, the quality of the education that we provide in 3-4 years covers 5 years of primary education. Our students are, in fact, 94% of our children actually get through primary schools, whereas our national system gets less than 60% passing the school system. So the 60 of them actually complete primary education with enough learning abilities or learning achievements, and we have that over 90%. So our quality is good, and we provide the best possible education. I just hope that Bangladesh government were to learn from us how to do it.
Is there any chance we are trying to
open up dialogue with the government. The government is always afraid that these fellows are going to ruin our system or whatever it is. But
right.
But anyway, and also afraid of creeping privatization, they think. So that's also a problem. So we are trying to work on opening up our national system to some of the methodologies that we use so that more children benefit, BRAC children.
Okay, thank you. Vicky, here's a question for you. In rural China, the main reason for school dropout is lack of relevance of education to children's lives. What does it mean for education to be relevant, and what can be done to make it more relevant?
Relevance is that what the child learns has meaning and can be applied to his family and to his community. Something that is meaningful. So this is why we have tried to ensure that anything the child learns is immediately related and applied to his family, to his community. So children also become agents of change in their communities, in health and environment and all the different issues of the curriculum. So this has been very key. Instead of just, we work with the national standards of each country, but then we deliver it in a different way through the learning materials we develop jointly with the country.
Okay. Andre, what are the options for charter schools to go to scale, and what are the obstacles to replicating the Agassiz School's success?
Well, the obstacles, funding. I mean, you need the funding to have the tools to execute a program that works, you know, and I think people don't have funding and people don't have the belief that the program's going to work. But that's what we're sort of trying to solve. I mean, we have an endowment fund that we'll pay for the school for forever, raise the money to make it happen. That hasn't been an easy process. And we have a program now that is in the process of proving that it can work. And I think if you can prove that, I think you do find funding to be a lot easier. So it's really as simple as somebody understanding that if they step up to the plate, they're going to get the result.
I know in California that facilities are a big obstacle to charter growth. Is that an obstacle for you in Nevada as well?
Well, it has been. We've partnered with the states. They gave us the land. We built a campus. But you know, this is what we wanted to be, sort of the mother lode, if you will, the thing you have to make sure succeeds. If we fail at what it is we're communicating, then this doesn't happen. But if we can succeed, so we built a pretty expansive campus. You know, our project is about a $41 million project. Not necessary from the standpoint of accomplishing the curriculum and everything that's happening inside those walls. Matter of fact, when celebrities come to town and they want to come see the school, whether they're coming to perform at my event or whether we have dignitaries or any sort of political leaders come and they want to go see the school on a weekend or during a holiday, I won't take them because I'm just showing them a building. You know, I'm not showing them what it's about. So it's not about the building, but it is about representing this as if you can build the best school for the first one in the most economically challenged area, you are creating something that people can't ignore.
Right. John, at the end of the day, schools must be linked to the respective ministries of education. For Room to Read, how are you linked to the ministries, and who are the teachers in your schools?
Yeah, well, we work with the ministries from the very beginning. We only want to work in countries where the ministries of education are willing to work with us, and we work in cooperation with them. The schools we build as an example and the libraries that we do are three-part agreements between the ministry, the local community, and Room to Read. So that's, for us, is very, very important. One of the main roles, we found all kinds of interesting help from the ministries. For example, in Khmer, in the Khmer language, the Ministry of Education, Youth, and Sports actually gives us pro bono consulting to make sure that when we do Khmer script, and apparently the Cambodians can argue about their language in a way that would make the French look lackluster in arguing about their language, the Cambodian Ministry of Education is willing to actually work with us to make sure that when we do Khmer script, it is proper Khmer script. So if you can actually get the MOE to be doing pro bono consulting for you through your local teams, I think you're doing something right. In terms of the teachers, this is obviously a big issue everywhere in the world. Wherever you are, teacher quality is always an issue. In Nepal, the average teacher makes $21 a month. So it's very difficult to attract really high-quality people to the profession, at least with any kind of economic incentives. I don't think that model really has been solved yet in many places of the developing world of teacher quality. What we are doing is working with the ministries to make sure that we actually will not go into a country if we don't think the ministry has a good teacher training program and does not have a good pipeline. So there are vacuums and there are vacuums. And there are countries right now where there just are super vacuums because the government does not yet even have a qualified teacher training program. So in that case, for us, we really can't go into those countries.
So do you have desire on behalf of communities to build libraries and schools, but then you can't staff them? And if so, do you teach the communities any organizing skills so that they can put pressure on their government?
Well, part of our challenge grant, we actually asked the communities to prove to us that they have an agreement with the ministry, which is quite often at the provincial Ministry of Education level, that they will have well-qualified and trained teachers showing up on day one. Now, quite often, it's not waving a magic wand, because the ministry might have the budget at the local level for 5 teachers, but we're building a school that goes through grade 8 or 9 or 10. And many times the parents will literally pass the hat, and the parents will donate more money. We've actually had our staff in Sri Lanka has actually given money out of their paychecks to help one of the schools that has not had enough teachers. And so we're trying to just bootstrap that solution. I think the important thing is, and we've opened 287 schools, we're opening 150 this year alone, there's never any silver bullet. There's never any one way to solve that problem. What we're trying to do is engage the community to say, how can we being the local Room to Read team that's all local national, and the community and the MOE together, solve that problem? So different villages end up having different experiences of how they solve that.
Okay, thanks. Speaking of teachers, here's a quick question. Does Brock pay the teachers, and if so, how much?
We pay our teachers in Bangladesh is about $18, and in Africa it's slightly more, it's about $22. Now, since we get most of the housewives who don't have other opportunities in the village to work, this $15 or $22 seems to be quite a sum of money, and many housewives want to work as a teacher. Now, if you were going to, and these are, of course, teachers who are part-time in the sense that they teach for 3 hours a day, 3 to 4 hours a day, and the rest of the time they're housewives. So it's an additional income they look at it as, and not a, so we don't call it salary, we call it stipend. One thing I wanted to say here, because I think I went to China, and now, teacher salaries has always been low in most societies, and they couldn't attract very high quality people into teaching. And what China is trying to do now is they are now attracting the best students out of universities and giving them fairly high salaries to become teachers. But then there is a huge number of teachers already recruited and teaching in schools. So how do they manage that? And what China has done is this young teachers who are very high quality, and they give them quality training, they're in school together with other people who are not so high quality. What they are trying to do is to get the other teachers who are already in existence, who are already in service, to upgrade them so gradually, so that their salaries could also rise. So they are not condemning them that forever you are going to be a second-rate teacher, giving them opportunities to rise. And then you have a teacher's salaries ranging from 10 to 3. Some teachers get $3. An hour, or some get 10. So it's like that. So they're trying to manage that way.
And create a career path of sorts.
Yeah.
Here's a question for the whole panel. If you could establish one partnership at CGI, who would it be with? So if you could each answer that quickly. Here's the dream question.
Where's Carlos Slim? Is he in the room?
That could be your answer. That's okay.
Someone who's maybe, for us, we're at an interesting point of our growth where we can scale massively. And I'll be clear, capital's the issue. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason that we should live in a world where 100 million kids don't go to primary school. That's just wrong. That's just a moral indictment on our world. And the cost of this is insanely low, so there's no reason we should not be tackling this thing head on. $1 million deployed in the developing world to this model can have 100,000 kids have access to their first bilingual library with proper local language books, a properly trained librarian, and ongoing monitoring and evaluation. $1 million hits 100,000 kids. $1 million can put 4,000 girls on scholarship for a year. $1 million gives you more than 1 million girl days of education. Why do we have 67 million girls not in school if it costs less than $1 a day, if $1 million can fund over 1 million girl days? If you're a feminist, and I am very proud to say that ich bin ein Feminist, this is an important issue, but it's also a really big issue if you're an environmentalist.
Are you saying this problem could be solved with $100 million?
I don't know how you solve the entire thing, but I do believe in the old theory, and this is a cliche, but I'll say it anyway. How do you eat an elephant? You eat it one bite at a time. What I would like to do, and we announced our goal yesterday, to 5,000 libraries in our first 8 years by the end of this year. We're going to do Moore's Law of Philanthropy. Moore's Law says that your chip speed doubles every 18 months. What we're doing is we're doing our next 5,000 in 3 years, in 3/8 the time. Mm-hmm. To do that, we need finances. We are 15% funded of this $25 million commitment we announced yesterday, which for me, it was not that I announced that I had $25 million. It was me announcing I was going to work my ass off to go raise $25 million to reach 1.5 million additional kits.
Hence the Carlos Slim partnership. I see. Vicky.
John at roomtoread.org.
I think we're needing a corporate partner that can help us scale up smartly. And we've already scaled up. You know, it's already there. Picked up by governments. It's already a proven model. It's cost effective. It's scalable. It has results. Very highly documented in evaluation. But at this moment, we need a corporate partner that can help us see how to move on, control the quality. We have a brand. I think that's what we would be needing at this moment, because we work with either public schools, private schools, name it. It's an educational model that has results, that it's proven. And what we need is how to smart scale. This is our main challenge at the moment. We want to control the quality. We want to learn all these dimensions of a good business partner.
Thank you.
In education and educating, you know, I firmly believe that when you stop learning, you should stop teaching. So my instinct would be to lean towards somebody that is doing this and overcoming obstacles and affecting children's lives and making a difference. So I vote you, Lorraine. I choose you.
Okay.
Me?
Dr. Abed.
Well, I have good backers. I've got Bill and Melinda Gates. I've got the Buffett family helping me out in education. And I've got now Lorraine Jobs. She's going to help me in setting up some high schools.
I didn't know this moderator called all that.
I think I would really like the British Prime Minister. He has got a lot of money to give away to Africa. And so I would really like to get Gordon Brown. I've got his father-in-law on my board in BRAC UK. So I hope that I'll be successful.
Okay. We have a few more questions, although I'm tempted to wrap there and take a breather. Actually, Dr. Abed, one last one for you. How do you overcome cultural and societal barriers that prohibit girls from not just being educated, but participating in the household economy, as in Afghanistan?
Well, one of the strength of the model of BRAC school is that we set them up in the village in which the girls live. So they don't have to walk or go to 2 or 3 kilometers. So basically they are within their village. So this is useful. Secondly, we get the community involved in the whole process. So it has to be community-led process of setting up a school, and selection of girls who will come to school is also done by them. But then what the problem I had, in order to make our schools very enjoyable, we had songs and dances in school. And we had mullahs stopping us from doing this in some schools. In fact, 100 of our schools were burned down in Bangladesh because they didn't like girls singing and dancing in school. So that's one problem, that in Afghanistan we have not started songs and dances, which makes school life so enjoyable. So that's the only difference. We had to take culture into consideration in Afghanistan. But in Africa, yes, they love it. So it works.
But you're a big believer in making school enjoyable for children.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. The children love school. They just never absent. Even if they're ill, they'll turn up in school.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you. That's all the questions, and I know that that we have some certificates to give out. I think we have the esteemed Mary Robinson to do that, and Jean might want to do a wrap-up of some of the other brainstorming ideas first. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. As Lorene said to me, having been at all five panels, there doesn't seem to have been as much card exchanging going on anywhere as at this final panel. In terms of ideas that other people have talked about, a big theme that was going on around the table is not using a cookie-cutter approach, recognizing as you go into different places, as we've been just talking about, that you have to make sure you understand the culture, the community, the differences. People, again, very interested in what is the ability to use the media, the internet, to spread success. Another theme that rightly comes up is the tension in wanting to maintain the consistency and quality and training for curriculum, and making sure that as you're expanding, you can keep up the quality that we've seen there. There was a tension in table comments about financing for scaling up, some arguing that it should be done more with be relying more on the private sector, while others arguing strongly that you really can't address these without long-term and predictable government funding. But I will say that most of the ideas that were mentioned at the table were really adequately discussed in this session, and so there really is a lot less to add at this point. I do just want to, before we go to our certificates, I just want to also thank Ari Alexander, great, who's done such a terrific job. Vicky Palmoa, Stacy Rubin, Steve Hendrickson, our great volunteers. Some of them are have to work with me more than they'd like. But thank you so much. And I will say again, we did something different this year, and I think we set a trend, which was, to be honest, table facilitators generally tended to be young people who were here to facilitate, who did not have knowledge of the specific topic. We decided to do it different. We went out and found 30 people who were experts, top experts who ran entire divisions at USAID, the World Bank, the major NGOs. I hope that you felt that they added a lot to your conversation. Normally we let the panelists go, but I want you to kind of stay in your chairs this time while we bring up our certificate presenter. She has a decent resume as well. I asked Mary Robinson, you know, it's very difficult when you meet these people who, you know, in the United States the tradition is, as you know, that you call a person forever what was their highest title they ever had. So it gets a little difficult when someone's been a governor and a senator, et cetera. Which do you call them? So Mary Robinson was the first female president of Ireland, serving from 1990 to 1997. She was also the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights from 1997 to 2002. She has been, I think, virtually everybody, but those of us who fight and work for a girl's education like to think that that has been her specialty as well. She wouldn't tell me how to address somebody who's been both High Commissioner and President. So with apologies to Wesley Clark, I'm going to designate her Supreme Commander of Development, Mary Robinson.
Thank you.
Well, I like the Supreme Commander bit. this has been a wonderful session. I was really delighted to hear such wisdom from our distinguished panel. And as I was listening, I was really thinking, you know, that we have to also bring the issue of education to where it was brought almost 60 years ago in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, where it is a human right. And it was very interesting and... very interesting, and I do urge United States citizens to read the speech of President Bush to the UN General Assembly, because he actually referred not only to the Universal Declaration and Article 1, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights, he also read out Article 26. So apparently he believes that education is a human right. And that's very encouraging because we weren't sure up to now. And the point I'm making is, you know, on that thing, should it be private sector, should it be public? Actually, I think there has to be, as in health is also a human right, a very big public commitment. And the private sector then works with the sense of a very important public commitment. Anyway, I didn't get up here to make a speech, so I'll stop now. I got up here to talk about other people who are very deserving of the certificate which they'll be getting because of the very significant commitments they've been making. And I have three of them, bring up here to the panel. And the first ones I would invite to come up are Mark Turcek, the Managing Director of Goldman Sachs, and Charles Harris, Executive Partner of SeaChange Capital Partners. I was saying hello to them earlier. And as they're making their way up, I'll describe the commitment they've made to use best practices and greater efficiency to raise growth capital for entrepreneurial, high-performing education nonprofits here in the United States. It'll be a project valuing $5 million over 2 years. And the interesting thing about it is that SeaChange, who are supported by Goldman Sachs, will identify nonprofits here in the United States with a record of measurable success, and they will direct growth capital to these organizations. So by helping to improve the flow of capital to successful high-impact nonprofits, SeaChange is hoping to create a new model of giving focused on investing in what works. Now, what I want to say about this is a very exciting and innovative model, but really listening to what we heard in this session, I hope it'll be a lead for others in the financial world generally to think of a similar approach to innovative nonprofits internationally. And like some of the innovative things we have heard about, innovative social entrepreneurs. Most of the really innovative social entrepreneurs that I've come across internationally in developing countries lack resources. So this is a model that may have more application, and I'm really delighted to give you both the certificate. And the second group that I want to invite up are the World Fund Executive Director Luan Zurlo and Steve Schindler, the CEO of Nextel International. And they have made a commitment to improve the teaching quality of Mexican education professors and secondary school teachers. So it's a kind of teaching of and training of teachers. It has a value of $800,000. And World Fund and their partners are committing to improve teaching quality among education professors and secondary school teachers in Mexico by funding an extensive training course at Dartmouth College. And as Supreme Commander, I'm going to be going to Dartmouth shortly, and I'll be checking up on this, but it does sound impressive. And one of the things that they're going to do is to encourage a teaching program which focuses on teaching skills that encourage youngsters to critical thinking, because a lot of the English teaching, as I understand, is by rote too much, and therefore obviously not bringing out. And they hope that over 50,000 students from all over Mexico will be positively affected over the 3 years of this program. So again, a very, very good. So, congratulations. Well done. Okay, and last on my list, but by no means least, a very significant project to the value of $31 million over 8 years. And I would invite the founder and executive director of the Committee for Democracy and Information Technology, CDI, Rodrigo Baggio, to come up. You're on your own on the stage, but the organizations involved in supporting CDI are Accenture, Vale do Rio Doce, ABN AMRO Bank, Philips and Skoll Foundation. And the project is to improve the lives of Latin America's most vulnerable families by enabling poor youth and adults to use information technologies as tools to access knowledge and information, to generate income, and to serve as leaders of positive change within their communities. And CDI intends to substantially expand the scope, quality and impact of its network of some 840 schools spanning 9 countries in Latin America by scaling up its models of IT-based solutions to enhance education and to alleviate poverty and promote local development. And then by granting access to IT resources to low-income individuals, CDI aims to indirectly affect as many as 3.3 million families, empowering them to harness these new technologies to help build their communities. And in addition to the schools network, CDI will scale up the quality and offerings of 36 regional offices to complement its academic institutions. So it's a big program. I wish you well with it, and I'm glad to give you this certificate. Okay, and I think there's a great education energy in this room, so let's keep it up for the next year. Thank you. Okay, well done.
Thank you very much, Supreme Commander. Normally that would be the end of our certificates, and we don't necessarily have formal certificates, but this has been an exceptional panel, and while we have been sitting here, a few people have decided in this final panel that they did not want to leave without doing a bit more. Could I? I'd like to ask Ruth Kaguya and Shirley Ann Jackson to come up, please. If you don't know Shirley Ann Jackson, she is by far considered the top expert, the top advocate as president of RPI. Of the push to get more women and minorities in the United States to become scientists, engineers, and technology. And Ruth Kaguya, who is here not just as a role of head of education for the World Bank, but as a representative of Kenya, her home country, as they were sitting there earlier together with Minister of Education Saitoti from Kenya, they decided, they just put together a $1.1 million commitment from RPI to work with the Kenyan government on science and technology and touching hundreds of thousands of students directly. And we don't have a certificate, but, you know, you can feel it in your heart from us. Thank you very much. Would Eileen Sweeney come up, please? And Vicky, stand up as well. Can you get a picture of the two of them? Eileen is with the... Eileen gave me her card yesterday. She said she's with Motorola, and she said, call me when this is over. We have to sit down. I really want to do something. There was something about this panel that made her decide she just couldn't wait. Motorola, thanks to her and to this panel, is committing at least $100,000 to provide in-kind technology to Vicky and Escuela Nueva to help them scale up. And before we do our last announcement, I have to mention three people in the room that are of some importance to me. First of all, I just have to thank my wife, Allison Abner, for thinking that it was worth taking my wonderful son, Miles, out of school, that this would be a better educational experience for him today. Like so many of your 12-year-olds, he already has an enormous heart and an enormous social conscience. I'm very proud of him. The United States government, we're not quite as strong on universal education as we'd like to be. And I also work for the Global Campaign for Education here, and we've been trying to push to do more. But we're very, very happy that at least there is a proposal, a piece of legislation called the Education for All Act of 2007, which is a bipartisan bill co-sponsored by Republicans Gordon Smith and Republican Spencer Bacchus and Senator Hillary Clinton and a congresswoman, actually a chairperson named Nita Lowy. That bill would take our funding from $500 million to $3 billion a year by 2012. It's what those of us are advocating push for. But the reason we're even at $500 million as opposed to $150 million is really due enormously to the one co-sponsor there who's in a position on the Appropriations Committee to make things happen. So if you were to ask who in the last 5 years was the MVP for education in the United States, you would say Congresswoman Nita Lowy. Could you stand up, please? I really want to thank everybody. I can't tell you how many times when I was in the White House, people would come up and say, you know, thank you for your service, thank you for your commitment. So here's a secret. It's really not a great sacrifice to get to work in the West Wing for the President of the United States. It's about the most fun, rewarding, wonderful thing. Now, what is impressive are people who are so far away from Air Force One or state dinners who work in the field year after year. When you're talking about sustainability, the way you get sustainability, people like my little brother who starts a Mosaic Youth Theater Group, and he doesn't just move on, he stays and stays. Wendy Kopp, Teach for America, stays and stays. Vicki Colbert, didn't you want to move on? Didn't you want to do something else? 30, 40 years. Fossil. Look at Andre. Anybody think he's not going to keep doing this 20, 30 years later? John Wood. Sustainability comes from the commitment of so many of these people. Sister Cyril, 50 years. Inderjeet, you know, if you want to congratulate anybody on their service, their sacrifice, their commitment, and you're trying to think of a name, social entrepreneur, NGO, I would just use the name hero. They are just my heroes. I'm honored to be among them. Nothing could end the Clinton Global Initiative better than this final announcement. Lewis Katz, could you come up? I know you don't like to have to do things like this, but I'm making you. If you were trying to look for somebody kind of in, you know, when President Clinton thinks of the people who've done well in the private sector, who personify, long before there was a Clinton Global Initiative, everything the Clinton Global Initiative was about, it's when I met Lewis Katz and Ray Chambers. We were doing the New Markets Initiative for President Clinton to try to get people to commit to investing in our own distressed areas. And that was when I first learned that the owners of the New Jersey Nets and other teams, Lewis Katz and Ray, that they took all of their profits, every single penny, and plowed it back for the most disadvantaged children in New Jersey. He does the same now as one of the owners of the New York Yankees, which just eliminated the Detroit Tigers. But we still like you, Lewis. He has in every way personified what the Clinton Global Initiative is about. And so he's going to make one part of Andre Agassi's life a little easy. And if Perry is here, you should feel free to come up as well. The next time somebody asks Andre how you scale up his great model, he'll be able to say, you go talk to inspired people like Lewis Katz, who, in addition to the two amazing boys and girls clubs he has built in Camden, one of the poorest cities in our country, where he was born and went to public school, he is now committed that he is going to do everything in his power to create an Andre Agassi model school in Camden. So could Andre come up?
with me? If I could get,
thank you.
If I could get her autograph, I'd be my favorite person ever. I mean, I know you all like tennis, but I love Toni Morrison.
Come on, Toni. Toni, come up and take a picture with Lewis Katz.
Thank you very much.
Toni, come on up. You see, can I tell you, the reason why Lewis isn't that inspired to just get a picture with Andre is he really only likes to be with pro athletes whose salary he pays.
What an inspiration this lady is.
So now we have two Toni Morrison exceptions. You can get acknowledged in the audience if you're Toni Morrison, and you can get your picture with her if you spend millions of dollars building an Andre Agassi school. They always complimented the broadcasters when the U.S. hockey team won the beat the Russians. For just not saying anything, just letting the moment speak for itself, I can't think of letting a better moment just speak for itself. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, immediately following this session, lunch is available outside the session rooms. The afternoon closing session will begin at 2 p.m. Please enjoy your lunch in this room.